Yeah, I'm Mark. I'm an alcoholic. Let's just start with the doctor's opinion. And I'm going to take a couple and show you how we take statements and we'll turn them into questions to consider where I'm at. And it starts out saying, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. And you know, Don turned to me and said, are you interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book? And then he followed that up with another question around convincing testimony. Are you interested in looking at convincing testimony from medical men who've had experience with the sufferings of our members and witnessed our return to health? Then it's going to go through and it's going to give you a brief introduction letter from Dr. Silkworth. And like Joe, I was given a little history on who this man is and what his contribution is. And of course, he'd worked at Towns and worked with many, many, many alcoholics. I want to share something that I just recently learned sitting there talking with a man who's got several degrees, and a lot of that has to do with information about the brain, and he's also in recovery. He made a very interesting statement to me. He said, so far, as far as I can tell, all medical and scientific evidence that has been discovered exactly matches the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was a book written out of observation. And this is a man who spends his life in doing research and scientific stuff and that kind of thing. And I wanted to mention that because it I guess, once again, reminds me about this book as well, a book on divine inspiration. So for me, I go over to XXIV in the doctor's opinion, and particularly I look at, it talks about the physician or our request gave us this letter. He's been kind enough to enlarge upon his views, another statement which follows. Now, in this statement, he confirms what we who've suffered alcoholic torture must believe. Now, I'm going to get introduced to quite a bit of must in this program, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. And I obviously can take and turn that into a question. You know, Mark, have you suffered from alcoholic torture? Well, I'm not sure. I've suffered a lot from drinking too much. I don't know if I know what he means by alcoholic torture. You know, are you willing to believe that you must believe that your body is quite as abnormal as your mind? See, the truth was for me, at 2.5 years in this program, when I sat down with Don, I didn't truly understand what happened to me once I took a drink. You know, and that's all we're looking at in the doctor's opinion, and what happened to my body once I put some alcohol in it. You know, and it goes on, and it talks about, you know, did it satisfy you to be told you couldn't control your drinking because you were maladjusted to life? Mark, were you in full flight from reality or an outright mental defective? And I mean, I had a lot of reasons why I drank alcohol, but in my gut somehow, I know those didn't justify what always happened once I started drinking. And it goes on to tell me those things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. It introduces me to this idea my body sickened as well. And question for me is, Mark, you know, do you think in your belief any picture which leaves this out, this physical factor, is incomplete? Doctor's theory, I have an allergy to alcohol, interests me. And again, the question for me is, you know, Mark, is this theory of interest to you? As laymen, our opinion as to a soundness may, of course, mean little. But as an ex-problem drinker, we can say his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And one of the things in there, the question Don asked me is, he said, did you ever have situations where once you took a drink of alcohol, you didn't get where you wanted to go? I said, ho-ho. Lots of times. And he said, in those situations, were there times when you were going to go somewhere and something was going to happen to turn out to your benefit? Yeah, many times. Well, he said, did you ever wonder why you never made it? And I said, yeah, I did. And he said, what's the most extreme example you can think of? And I thought of one. I was living with a lady, and she had a couple kids, and she had a young baby, and I went to the grocery store to get milk, and on the way I stopped at Bennington's. I'm going to have a drink. And I woke up 8 days later in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And I remembered very little any of that. And, you know, I never could understand that because I loved the woman. My intent was to stop in and have one drink. And my drinking history was full of that kind of a situation, and I had no answer for that. And he said, maybe we'll get an answer for that when we look at this thing. And then you go and you start to get into this further letter that the doctor's going to write. Subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. Again, what is the question? You know, Mark, Are you willing to take a look at what's presented in here, and are you afflicted with alcoholic addiction? The paragraph that opens some eyes for me is the one about it says, we doctors, and I'm going to read this one way, and then I'm going to read it again. It says, we doctors realized for a long time some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, the scientific approach to everything, we're perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good to lie outside our synthetic knowledge. And Don asked me what that meant, and I said to him, tell you the truth, I'm not real sure. And he read it a little bit different, and it really had a lot of meaning for me. And it speaks to me that doctors aren't going to fix me. We doctors realized for a long time some form of spiritual experience was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but the application of a spiritual experience presented difficulties beyond doctors' conception. What with doctors' ultra-modern standards, doctors' scientific approach to everything, doctors are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside of doctor's synthetic knowledge. A lot of information there for me to look at. And, you know, moving forward for me, and then when I get done here, I'm sure Joe will have some additional comments, but if you turn over to the page where it starts, I'm on XXVI, where it says, we believe, and so suggest a few years ago, an action of alcohol in a chronic alcoholic's manifestation of an allergy. And I used a dictionary in some of this work, and of course, what I discovered in the process of using a dictionary is you can't treat allergies. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never, uses the word never, occurs in an average tempered drinker. That was important for me, particularly when I looked at my early drinking, because there were times when I couldn't relate to craving. Well, they use the word never. I guess if it ever happened once to me, I'm not them. Went on to say these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And that sentence is for those of you who might be in here that like to drink near beer. It says never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they couldn't break it, these were powerful questions to me. You know, Mark, did you form the habit and found you couldn't break it? Yeah. Did you lose your self-confidence? Yeah. Did you lose your reliance upon things human? Uh-huh. Did your problems pile up in you? Yeah, a whole bunch. Did they become difficult to solve? Yeah. Well, maybe that's because you have this thing called allergy to alcohol, and it breaks out in craving. And I tested that. At that time, I was working in retail, and I was managing a store, and I went back in, and I did this the night after I did this thing with Don, and I grabbed a couple of my salesmen. I said, I want to ask you some questions. And they weren't alcoholic, but I knew they drank. And I asked these questions, and they did not answer these questions like I did, which I thought was interesting. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices, most of all mine, let alone anyone else. You know, I don't know about the rest of you, but everybody on the planet cared about me used frothy emotional appeal, none of which worked at all. Message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. The only message that's ever worked for me is sitting across from another drunk who's had an experience with alcohol, can't quit, wants to quit, doesn't understand. And that person doesn't drink anymore. And that person has a solution for me. That's the message that has depth and weight for me. Goes on to say, in nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their life. That's a powerful question. I love the promise of being able to recreate my life. And most of us sitting in this room, I've seen that happen in this program and in this fellowship. Bottom of that page, a real powerful paragraph for me. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I mean, I love that when I hear an alcoholic tell me he drinks because he likes the taste. You know, I like spring water, but I didn't sit down and drink a case of it or a fifth at a time. I got real clear and I drank for effect, you know. And this effect gets so elusive, well, after a while, admits it's injurious, but I can't tell the differentiate true from the false. And I don't know about the rest of you, but when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the people I ran with were doing what I was doing. Seemed real normal to me. You know, and to Mark, his alcoholic life seemed a normal one. Now I'm going to get introduced to something that I had never looked at before. And this described me. And, you know, Mark's restless, irritable discontent, unless he can again experience a sense of ease and comfort. Comes at once by taking a few drinks which Mark sees others taking with impunity. After Mark's come to the desire again, as he would so often do, and craving developed, I went through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful. Firm resolution not to drink again, and this is repeated over and over, unless Mark can experience entire psyche change with little hope of his recovery. Now I'm really starting to look at this thing maybe called the spiritual malady book's going to get into, because when I'm sitting across from Don at this point in time, I can assure you I've related to restless, irritable, discontent. He said something to me. He said, you know what the big difference is between me and you right now? I said, what? He said, if you're around this program, Mark, and he said, you're not happy and got some sense of serenity and peace for a little bit of period of time, and you're restless, irritable, and discontent, you're going to seek ease and comfort. And he said, if you don't have some spiritual tools to pick up, there will come a time when this thing called the obsession of the mind is going to come in and you're going to pick up a drink again. And everything he said made a lot of sense to me, and particularly that made sense because the 2.5 years in this program, after not having gone through this work, precisely, specifically, looking at what was wrong with me, I can assure you from the time I got up till the time I went to bed, I was restless, irritable, and discontent, saying to myself once again, I'm in the wrong place. Well, I wasn't in the wrong place, but I certainly hadn't moved on to a solution. That's a real, real powerful, powerful paragraph to me. A lot of questions in there that I had to answer. Are you restless, irritable, and discontent, Mark? Yeah. What gave you ease and comfort? Booze. But did you reach a place and time where you're restless, irritable, and discontent and didn't want to drink booze, but nothing else gave you ease and comfort? Yeah. I mean, you know, I go to a lot of meetings, and I don't know about the rest of you, but booze is my solution for a tremendous number of years. People talk about booze being a problem. It created problems, became a problem, but it was my solution. So I better get something more powerful. I mean, I sat in AA for 2 years real angry because you took away the only solution to this thing called restless, irritable, and discontent. And again, it tells me that I had to look at this. Was your experience like this, Mark? Did you repeat this over and over again? Yeah. And it goes on to tell me that unless I experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of my recovery in there. And again, I'm going through open-minded at that time, but, you know, I had to ask Don about the psychic change, and he talked to me about Dr. Silkworth using the term psychic change, and a little further on, Dr. Young using the term spiritual experience. And there's different ways to say the same thing. Bottom line is, Mark, you got to go through some major changes, and you can't produce them on your own. Then it goes on, talk a little bit more, another paragraph about faced with this problem, if the doctor's honest, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. I'm once again faced with the idea doctors aren't going to help me. And then he gets into this thing of, I don't hold with those who believe alcoholism is a problem of mental control. Talks about, I've had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorable. Took a drink a day or so prior to the date, the phenomenon of craving became paramount to all their interests. So the important point was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. We looked at that, asked myself a lot of questions in that. Now all of a sudden I begin to get answers why I never showed up for places once I took the first drink. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. My best friend, when I was about a little over a year sober, came into the fellowship out in California. And I love this guy more than I loved any of my blood brothers. And he was too smart for this program, and he went in and out and in and out. And I got a phone call one morning from his wife at about 8:30, and third day into a drunk behind the craving, he took my 38 and blew his brains out. That man would never have done that sober. So this paragraph has had a tremendous impact on me and in my life and about me carrying this message. You know, I go to meetings, and it's almost like a relapse is a damn badge of honor. And what I know for me is a relapse, I could do the same thing that my friend did. This is what this sentence is saying to me, that behind craving, I might make the supreme sacrifice. Because I don't know about the rest of you, but when I got here, I was done. I was absolutely done. Then the book goes through and does some classifications of alcoholics, and you know, I'm in every one of those. Of course, I wanted to be in the one neat little paragraph that says there's the types entirely normal in every respect. And of course, that wasn't me.
That's me.
Yeah, that's Joe. Then it sums me up again. All these and got many others. We've got one symptom in common. They can't start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. And by then, I've answered so many questions around myself and what happens to me once I take a drink. The other thing that was interesting in that is we didn't look at how much I drank and how often I drank. We looked at just what happened. And I'm grateful that was given to me. A sponsored man one time, he's a school teacher. For 9 months of the year, dry as a bone. About June 1, he'd go out and start with about 10 cases of beer in his garage. Didn't see anything unusual about that. By about the middle of August, he'd go to detox, damn near dead. Didn't think he was an alcoholic. Why? Stayed dry 9 months of the year. Book doesn't ever let me look at that. Makes me look at one thing. Mark, when you put alcohol in your body, what happens to you? Does this thing called craving show up in you? Goes on to say it's the manifestation of an allergy. It's going to differentiate me and set me apart as a distinct entity. I remember Don saying, do you feel like a distinct entity? Yeah, absolutely. It's never been by any treatment with which we're familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And then it goes on to say that precipitates us into a cauldron of debate. And the reason is real simple. Dr. Silkworth can say to the alcoholic, here's the deal. You're allergic. Okay? Your body's different. Someone else is doing to have this thing called alcoholism. So it's real simple. Just don't ever drink again. Bye. Have a nice day. But of course, he just watched them die. He gave them that information, and they died time and time again. And you could give me that information, and that wasn't going to stick with me. And so consequently, they're going to get into a debate, and it goes on to say, general opinion seems to be most chronic alcoholics are doomed. So I see over and over again this thing about me. What happens to Mark once he takes a drink of alcohol? There's another piece in there about that information and why I need to really understand this. And this word about I can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Once having gotten that information, I don't know if I can believe the lie if I can pick up a drink and get different results. I mean, I've gone through and looked at this thing 11 times, and every time it hits me at the gut at a deeper level. And I know today that NyQuil's not available to me, and neither is anything else. Had a brief experience with this. A friend of mine sent me some of this new health food stuff and a little bottle that said rocket fuel on it and bee pollen and whatever, and I didn't read all the ingredients. And so I take about 6 drops of that stuff. And I'm sitting there and I'm talking to another alcoholic. It's about noontime, and I started to get this feeling all over me. And I said, I remember this feeling, but I ain't felt it in a long, long time. And I pick up the ingredients, and the little bottom ingredients, it says grain spirits. Doesn't say how much, just says grain spirits. And I chucked that away, and I called this person back and said, don't send me any more rocket fuel. You may never see me again. And I got a chance after being sober. That just happened last summer. I'd been sober a long time. There were only 6 or 7 little drops in a very minute part. And that hit my tongue, and within about 10 minutes, my body was aglow. And it was not a spiritual connection to God that was taking place in me. That's really all I got to say on the doctor's opinion. I'll let Joe share a little bit here.
I remember when I heard people talking about this craving. And I had all this past experience in treatment centers and college and a lot of knowledge about the body of an alcoholic. And the word craving kept it up here in my head. But when somebody gave me a simple question, do you lose control over the amount once you start to drink? It felt like it brought it back down here somewhere in my chest. Then when somebody added a word to that I should look at my intent for when I would start to drink. What was my intent when I would start to drink? And I went back, and it seemed like that word intent brought it down to specific times. And I would go back to those times where I had... See, I heard a guy say one time that he's alcoholic because every time he drank, he got drunk. But I know there's people in this room that set out to get drunk and couldn't. Those times where you would drink and it would just get tighter and tighter and tighter, and you couldn't get drunk, and you drank right back to sober. And I know there's people in this room that set out times to get drunk and did. And I know there's people in this room that set out times to not get drunk and did. So I don't say that I'm powerless over alcohol in this physical sense once I take a drink, because every time I drank, I got drunk. Because there were times my intent was different than getting drunk, and it didn't go the way I wanted it to. And I don't go back to the times where I just set out to get drunk because I was with the right guys, and that's a great night to party. I go back to the times where I set out to make the date at 9 o'clock, to make it home at 10:15, to make the appointment tomorrow morning, to not break her heart again and be there at 11 o'clock, like I said, and couldn't. And something, it explained, I love that where it says it explained many things that I could never otherwise account. The day of my dad's funeral, I'm brought to my mother's house by a guard from a little white room in a mental institution. I was allowed to go to my father's funeral, and I went across the street to see a friend just to say hello. He asked me, did I want a beer? I said, I'll have a couple just to take the edge off. And somewhere between that second one and the 20th one, I lost the kind of power it takes to choose how much I was going to drink, and showed up at my father's funeral drunk to the point where the guard that brought me tied me to a tree by my ankle with a chain, and I didn't choose to do that. And when I read a line like, not drinking to necessarily escape, even though probably everybody in this room had times where they drank to escape, but what about those times where you were okay and you weren't drinking to escape anything, but drinking to overcome a craving beyond your mental control? And there's some words I wanted to look at here for a minute. I think Mark showed us how you can read, you can sit with a drunk you're working with, or you can sit there with the doctor's opinion by yourself or your sponsor, and you can read that chapter, turning every statement that you possibly can into a question to yourself or that guy that you're working with. Am I restless, irritable, discontented? You cannot move from where you are and have a new experience with these steps unless you honestly admit where you are. You cannot get from Santa Monica to Palm Springs if you think you're in Los Angeles. You have to admit, I am in Santa Monica and I want to get to Palm Springs. You must admit where you are to get to point B. You must admit where you are to get to somewhere new. Yes. Where am I with booze, 11 and a half years sober? It's one thing to say I experienced the first step the first time I sat down with Don Pritz and looked at the first step and this chapter came alive for me. It's another thing to say that I experienced 3 weeks ago, the first week in January, a personal experience with this part of my disease 11 and a half years away from my last drink. Where am I with this idea that if I was to take a drink, this craving would happen? Where am I with that today? Can this part of the first step, this first half of the first step, which talks about the physical craving and the mental obsession, be experienced in your gut 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years away from your last drink? I know that it can. It has each time for me that I've been willing to open myself up to it. The most that I can tell you about looking at the first 8 pages of Bill's story is to see what you relate to. And I'll read that paragraph that I've never seen an alkie not relate to almost every single word on page 8, where Bill describes his final bottom for the last time, even though he drank again after this, once, I think. He says here that no words can describe the loneliness and despair that he found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Everything was closing in around him from all directions. I met my match. I was overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. I relate to every single word in that paragraph from my last bottom, August 17, 1982. But what about when you start to consider his recovery and you start looking at page 9 to 16 and you start asking yourself, 11 and a half years sober, what does it mean to go to any length, and do I even comprehend what that means? To get another year of sobriety, to make it to 12, to make it to 13, to make it to 14. So let me share my experience. January 1st, I called a man and I asked him to take me through the steps this year. He says, come on over, we'll talk about it. I went over. He says, why are you here? I said, I want to do the work again. He said, why do you want to do the work? I said, because I don't ever want to drink again. He said, what? He said, that's baloney. You know how to not drink. You know how to not drink for 11 and a half years. And tricked me into, within 5 minutes, I was agreeing, yeah, you know what, Rod? I think I probably do know what it takes to stay sober 11 and a half years. I probably do know how to stay sober. He said, well, you share it with people, everyone you sponsor. You tell them how to stay sober. And within 5 minutes, he had me tricked. And there I was. You know what, Rod? I think I really do know what it takes to stay sober. He said, but do you know what it takes to stay sober 12 and a half years? Do you know what it takes to stay sober 13 years? said, no. He said, what about going to any length? I said, sure. I've answered that 10 other times with 10 different people. I ask guys that all the time. He said, you sure you're willing to go to any length? I said, yeah. He said, do you know what that means in 11 and a half years? What I might ask you to do? I said, no, but I'm willing. I'm willing to go to any length. Then he lightened up the conversation for another 10 minutes. We're talking about all this other stuff. And all of a sudden he says, length. And I'm a guy that sits in my living room at least. And I sit in my living room almost every day with a drunk that wants to recover. And I have never gone a month without speaking in the 7 years I've lived in California. And 10 minutes later, he said, what about going to any length? I said, sure. He said, okay, this is what you're going to do. You're going to read the first 164 pages. You're going to answer these three questions. You're going to read the first three chapters and get in touch with your drinking again. You're not going to work with any new drunks. And you're not going to speak for a month. And I said, what about the guys I'm sponsoring that are in inventory that I've put all this time into? And he laughed. He said, do you hear what you just said? I said, no. He said, that you've put all this time into. How arrogant is that? Are you the only one that can help them recover in all of Los Angeles? I said, well, I had no clue what it meant to go to any length. I had no clue that he was going to ask me to drop everything that I subconsciously now thought was keeping me sober. Not the things I do to carry the message, the things I'm doing once again to keep myself sober, to keep away from getting to an admission again. There's nothing I can do to keep myself sober, and it's only by the grace of God. And any lengths meant something different at 11 and a half years than it did it the first time. And to drop everything that I was attached to was a fabulous experience. Because see, a sponsor doesn't keep me sober. And the people I work with don't keep me sober. And this book doesn't keep me sober. And these steps don't keep me sober. And those meetings don't keep me sober. But I lose sight that all those things together have gotten me in touch with a power greater than myself that keeps me sober. I'll worship the fingers rather than see what they point to. Once again, 11 and a half years sober, there I am thinking I'm doing something to keep myself sober. What did our friend Paul Martin call it? Rocking chair sobriety. A lot of action. No, a lot of motion, but no action. You don't get anywhere in a rocking chair, right? 17 to 23 can be done the same way as we did with the doctor's opinion. You learn how to turn statements into questions. They talk about choice. I'm sorry, that's after page 23. But they do talk about three important things that we should identify on the bottom of page 20. They look at the moderate drinker who has little trouble giving up liquor entirely if he has a good reason for it. Is that me? Can I take it or leave it? I've never had a problem that I'm not the moderate drinker. But what about the hard drinker? He may have the habit badly enough to be gradually impaired physically and mentally. That's me. It might even have caused me to die a few years before my time. That's me. But give the hard drinker a sufficiently strong reason, this guy can stop or moderate, even though he might find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. And why don't we realize that we're surrounded by those people in AA that all they needed was a sufficient reason, and they do not have to do what we have to do to get power in their life to stay sober? Because on the outside, they sound just like us. If you and the hard drinker in AA go back to the bar and talk about what it was like, he might have been able to drink you under the table. He might have gotten in 10 times more trouble than anybody in this room. He might even have died. But all he needed was a sufficient reason that brought him to AA, and he's never had to do nothing. His life has gotten better, and he's got power not to drink and change his life, and he can change everything about himself, and everything is just fine. And I found everything I wanted in the fellowship of AA, and when I walked through the doors, I was home. Not my experience. 5.5 months after walking through these doors, I was dying of a part of the disease I didn't even know I had, and every sufficient reason I was ever given, I was unable to stay stopped. I am not a hard drinker. I am not a person you can give a sufficient reason to, nor am I somebody who can change everything about myself because now I have a good reason to. At some stage of my drinking, I lost control over the amount once I started to drink, and that's all the whole section is designed to help you look at. Why do you lose control over the amount once you start? Why are you powerless over alcohol physically once you take the first drink? And there I am, back to the truth about my drinking. Not only that that happened in the past, but that if I was to take a drink of booze tonight, he also tricked me the last time I went to see this guy that I asked this time. Last time I went to see him, he scared me away. Because I didn't let that tension move me through the steps. I let that tension scare me away. Last time I went to see this guy, he said, let's you and me go to the liquor store right now, sitting right here in our imagination. Let's imagine going to the liquor store. And he took me right there, and I'm looking at the wall, and I'm picking out a bottle of Absolut, because I love vodka. I just absolutely love vodka, right? And he said, now what size would it be? I said, I want a fifth. He said, now where would that first fifth take you? And I started into this long, elaborate story about where that first fifth would take me, and he laughed and he shook his head and he said, you go home and pray about that. And I went home and I prayed about that for a week, and one morning I woke up in hysterics, realizing, you know what, Joe? I don't have a clue where that first fifth would take me. It might be great. It might work. It might be absolutely fine the next morning, not a problem in the world. It might not hit me till day 7. Boom! But I wouldn't be in control of when that day would come. I might be dead that night. I might be back in AA the next morning, whining and crying and complaining. I might be in Tijuana at my mother's house, checking into treatment, all the way to Michigan, New York before it ends, or dead. I do not have a clue where that first fifth would. My ego wants to convince me that it knows where alcohol will take me, as much as it wants to convince me that it knows what the day I'm going to drink again would look like, so I can prevent that day from ever looking like that. Now, before we move from 23 to 43, where's my little chalkboard girl? Those notes will be up there for section 2 after our session tonight, but now we're going to move into section 3. We got till 10:20. I'd like you to write these words down. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 words. What I want, need, choose, desire, what's necessary, needed, or right. Let me repeat those 7 words. Want, need, choice, desire, what's necessary, what's needed, and what's right. You look at those 7 words in relationship to 2 questions, you can get in touch with the first half of the first step. And all you have to do is look at those 7 words in relationship to, can I control the amount? Once I start by want, desire, choice, what's needed, wanted, necessary, or right, can I control the amount that I'm going to drink once I start to drink? And once I stop, can I stay stopped because of my desire, what I want, what I choose, what I need, want, what's right, necessary? Do any of those words have anything to do with what happens to me once I start to drink or once I stop? Can I keep myself stopped? Because see, that's the question now. We're going to look at section 3 from page 23 to page 43. And this is the mind. This is what takes place in my mind before I even take the first drink, which we call the mental obsession. And here's a pertinent question for this whole section. Why am I powerless over alcohol mentally before I even take the first drink? And some instructions on how to work with that section. Just continue turning statements into questions from 23 to 43. One more thing, and then I want to ask Mark to go from those pages. Without sounding intellectual or too complicated, there's 2 things I'd like to share that I had to get free of in relationship to both of these questions with the first half of step 1. Here's the 2 questions again. Joe, why do you lose control over the amount? Why do you drink so much once you start to drink? We watched you at that party the other night. and you had a couple beers, and it was like something came over you and you were just off. Why do you drink so much once you start? Or you got the wife or the girlfriend saying, how come every time you stop, and it seems like after what happened last time that you learned your lesson, why do you start again? Why do you start again once you stop, and why do you lose control over the amount once you start? Faced with those two questions, let me show you what your ego is going to want to do. Your ego is going to want to keep the answer to those questions outside of you. Example. Why do I drink so much once I start? Well, her. I mean, anybody that was with someone like that would have to drink a lot once you start. It's her fault. Or the weather, or the team, or the bank account, the car, the clothes, or the job. The ego wants to keep, write this in big letters if you're taking notes. The ego wants to keep the problem outside of me so it doesn't have to take any responsibility or when the team won, or when the bank account was full, or when you weren't working, or when you were working, or when it was rainy or sunny or cloudy. And all of a sudden I start to see circumstance. The circumstances of my life have nothing to do with why I crave booze once I put it in my system. It simply has to do with a body that doesn't process alcohol very well. And circumstance, from the penthouse to Skid Row in Miami, I take a drink and it takes me wherever it wants, amount, behavior, what I'm going to do, where it's going to end, or how much I'm going to drink. It's in control. I am powerless over alcohol once I put it in my system, regardless of the circumstance in my life. Then what your ego will try to trick you into, that it's an emotional state. I drink that way once I take a drink because I'm feeling bad. I met a guy in Hollywood one time. He was going to trick me with the book. And he was going to say, he obviously didn't know who he was talking to at the moment, but he said, you know, the book says they realized they only knew a little and more will be revealed. And we in the 90s have realized more has been revealed. And we in the 90s have realized alcoholism is not a physical, mental, and spiritual disease that no human power can relieve. I said, oh, what have we realized? I wanted to ask him who we were, but I was more interested in what they had found. I said, oh, what have we realized in the 90s? He said, we in the 90s have realized alcoholism is a feeling disease based in shame. Ask these guys that have been around here a lot longer than me how about every 2 or 3 years there's a whole new set of buzzwords in AA that filter down into our program from our so-called friends, right? I have a friend that says, know who your friends are and be friends with your friends, but know who your friends are. There are people that claim to be friends of Alcoholics Anonymous that can't even share our message because they charge money for something we give away for free, right? So, I say to this guy, let me ask you a question. See, in my home group, we're allowed to ask each other questions during the meeting. I know it's a radical idea, but we ask each other questions before the meeting, during the meeting, and after the meeting. And I said, let me ask you a question. I'm also used to asking questions to drunks sitting in my living room. I said, did you ever drink again when you really didn't want to, when you were feeling really bad and you were full of shame? He said, yeah, see? And I already had won. I knew I'd already won. I'd already won the game. It was over. I said, did you ever drink again when you really didn't want to, when you were feeling really good and there wasn't any shame at all? He said, well, yeah. I said, did you ever drink again when you weren't feeling much at all? He said, yeah. I said, did you ever drink again when you really didn't want to just feel something? He said, yeah. I said, did you ever drink again when you really didn't want to not feel anything? He said, yeah. I said, then what the hell does alcohol care about how you feel, whether you drink it again or not? So here I am, faced with a question, why do you drink so much once you start? And my ego wants to go to circumstance, her, them, this, that, the other, has nothing to do with circumstance. Then it'll go to my emotional state. Well, I felt bad. No. I get a craving feeling good. I get a craving when I'm feeling bad. I get a craving when I'm not feeling much at all. My first step has nothing to do with circumstance or emotional state. Then you're faced with the next question. Why do you always drink again every time you stop and you say you're never going to drink again? And my ego wants to do the same thing. Because of her. Because she stays. Well, what about when she left? Well, it did it then too. Because the team won. Well, what about when the team lost? And they break it down the same way. Well, I would always drink again because I would feel bad. Well, wouldn't you drink again when you were feeling good? Same thing. Try to look at these two parts of the first step. What happens before you even take a drink, and what happens after you take a drink, without circumstance or emotional state having anything to do with your admission.
I had a Joe got me thinking last year when I went through the work. I saw the first step, particularly around the pages we're going to look at, the next 20 in the mind, in a way I'd never seen before, and it wasn't an intellectual thought thing. When I got to the bottom paragraph on page 43, I just started crying, and I was sitting with a couple guys, and they said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what's wrong is I'm sitting here sober today through the grace and mercy of a loving God, and my head has been telling me for years on end if I keep doing all these things, somehow I'd earn the path to sobriety or somehow gain knowledge or do whatever." And hopefully some of you can reach a point of maybe understanding that too. And then the other thing that happened for me in a little bit different way when about this willing to go to any length is early November, this Steel on Steel meeting. The group confronted me real heavily on, I've been real involved in doing workshops and working a lot with people. And basically what they did is they said, I need to entertain the idea of stopping all that. And I said I would do that for a week, and I got real, real uncomfortable, and I had to ask myself, what are you getting so uncomfortable about? And I began to understand something, that once again, what was creeping back in is somehow this idea of power comes from working with others. And a lot of those other things took place, and so what I really done since that point in time is I really haven't worked with other alcoholics, and it was like going through withdrawals. I mean, if I'm a loner and I got this book and the book says that I can begin and do this thing in that process, you know, am I putting power in this thing and sitting across from everybody time and time again? And what it keeps taking me back to is this relationship with God, this power, and not worshiping this book and not worshiping my one-on-one work and not worshiping my meetings and not doing any of those other things. So we're going to get to page 23, and looking at me with booze in my body is going to stop, and says, Mark, these observations are academic and pointless if you never took the first drink, therefore setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, your main problem centers in your mind rather than in your body. And they're going to go through, and they're going to ask me questions about the last bender and a lot of other questions. I had an interesting experience a couple weeks ago. I was sitting with small group of some men and women who had been sober, one of them as long as 12 years, and they had relapsed, and a couple eight, and some four, and some two, and I went around the room, and I asked them the question, do you believe, after being sober for 12 years, that you chose to pick up, drink alcohol again? And every single person in that group said, absolutely. And I said, the tragedy in that is you've never understood the mind part of what this disease is all about. They said, what do you mean? I said, well, I've never met a stupid alcoholic. And I said, based on what booze has done with you, because some of you shared what's happened, don't you think it'd be stupid to be 12 years sober and pick up a drink again? Yeah. Well, do you think that was a choice? He goes, damn, maybe it wasn't. And I said, well, good. Now maybe we can get somewhere looking at this thing. It's like going to a meeting and you hear those wonderful words, I got up today and chose not to drink alcohol. See, what I know is a moderate drinker and a hard drinker, the fellowship is enough. But for the real alcoholic, for this real alcoholic, the fellowship is not enough. What has to be enough for me is a spiritual experience and a relationship with God. And it goes on and talks about the man gets a once in a while he may tell the truth. And the truth, strange to say, is he has no more idea why he took the first drink than you have. And then they introduced me to this idea of being baffled, and I can relate to that a lot, and the word obsession. And the book uses several words, and if you look them up, the word obsession is an interesting word to look up. It basically tells me I got a belief system that is not based in truth, and that really describes me in alcoholism. And And the big book doesn't use the word denial, the first 164 pages. It uses the word delusion. And there's several words that hook in there, obsession, delusion, and illusion. And bottom line of every one of them is, I'm going to reach a place where I'm going to believe a lie, and I'm going to take a drink based on that. And what's the lie? Oh, I'll get ease and comfort. It'll be different this time. And regardless of how long I've been sober, that can happen to me. That's what I got to look at in here. And then it goes on a little bit, bottom of the page. The tragic truth is, if the man's a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. Why? Because he's lost control. And then I'm given the sentence that smashes this idea, desire to quit drinking is going to keep me sober. Certain point in my drinking, I passed into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking was of absolutely no avail. And this next paragraph always has been, for me, one that is not only powerful, but produces a lot of terror and keeps what I call fire in the belly real active in me. And here's what it speaks to me about. And it says, I've lost the power of choice in drinking. It's interesting. There's no little subtitles in there. It doesn't say because I've been sober 28 years. It doesn't say because I sponsor people. It doesn't say because I do workshops. It doesn't say because I know the book. It doesn't say any of that. It says, I've lost the power of choice in drink. And it tells me that my so-called willpower will become practically non-existent. My willpower. And I may be unable at certain times, not every time, to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force and memory the suffering humiliation of a week or month ago. I am without defense against the first drink. And it makes me puke at meetings where I hear this stuff. Yeah, I got up this morning and chose not to drink alcohol. I always go up to those people and I say, do you have a big book? Uh-huh. I'd like to see it. Why? Because it's obviously a hell of a lot different than mine. You know, because that is not what mine says. I've lost the power of choice with no subtitles. And then it gets on. Another big one in AA is think through the drink. The almost certain consequences of fall of taking a glass of beer will not crowd into my mind to deter me. If these thoughts occur, that implies to me they may not. And that has happened to me in my experience when I was out there. I call it struck drunk. It was my only effort at trying to comply with the world around me about me and my drinking. It lasted about 10, 11 days, and I'm going to head up to Aspen, Colorado, and 5 days later I wake up in some little town called Carbondale, real, real drunk, and I have absolutely no memory of getting out of my car, going in and buying the booze and going through that process. And goes on to say, at the bottom of this page, when this sort of thinking is fully established, an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid. Well, the fellowship consists of human beings, so I don't think the fellowship is going to keep me sober, because that's where human aid is. And it's given me some things to look at here and some more questions. You know, Mark, have you placed yourself beyond human aid? Yeah. Have you placed yourself beyond human aid over 11 years sober? Yeah, I think so. And it gives me some options. Locked up, I'll die, go permanently insane. And then, top of page 25, and but for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop but cannot. So I've seen a lot of powerful information in the first 25 pages. This allergy of the body. What happens to Mark when he takes a drink of alcohol. This obsession of the mind. The fact that I have lost choice. That I have no mental defense. That I certainly can't think through a drink. And then squiggly lines again. There's a solution. They start out telling me what I'm not going to like. I'm not going to like the self-searching, the levity of the pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. Now I'm showing some requirements for the solution in this program. Powerful stuff. It's kind of like what Joe said. Take a look at what you're not willing to do. You know, you're willing to be self-searching. You're willing to throw it against the wall and say, "Me, after 11 years, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Maybe I don't need God." Wow, that's an interesting idea. I don't know about the rest of you, but if I'm not a drunk, I'd probably be somewhere else. You know what I'm saying? I spend a lot of time around this fellowship. That's another reason, another thing that I ask myself when I go through the work. Maybe I'm not. Maybe I don't need God anymore. Maybe so much has happened to me that I don't need God anymore. That's an interesting thing to entertain. So it goes on to tell me, confession of shortcomings. You willing to do that, Mark? 11 plus years sober? which the process requires for its consummation. Saw that it worked in others, and I've come to believe in the hopeless futility of life as I've been living it. When therefore I'm approached by those in whom the problem has been solved, there was nothing left. See, I'm in a place again, I gotta ask myself. You've been away from alcohol for a while. Are you at a place where again there's nothing left for you to do, pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at your feet? That's not about me the first time through the work. That's about me after having gone through the work a lot of times. Am I at this place again where there's nothing left for you to do but pick up this kit of spiritual tools? I mean, this book's going to tell me my hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience. I understand maintenance real well. Do I understand growth? I got to throw it all against the wall if I want to keep growing. And I know from talking to a lot of people who had a lot more time sober than I did who relapsed, what I really keep hearing from them was no lack of spiritual growth. Oh, they understood maintenance. They had their home group meetings they went to all the time. They had a certain number of people they sponsored all the time. Sometimes used their sponsor, sometimes not. Hadn't been through the work, but maybe once or twice or three times. I didn't see any spiritual growth in them. Found much of heaven, been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence which had not even dreamed. And then it goes on to tell me, and I love this next paragraph because, once again, it gets me back into the idea that I better get a relationship with God. Because it tells me what's going to happen. It's like Bill does an aside in theater or something. He's talking to me and all of a sudden he turns aside and here's what he says. You can have a deep and effective spiritual experiences. And he tells me what's going to happen. It'll revolutionize my whole attitude toward life, toward my fellows, and toward God's universe. See, I want that to happen for me again in 1994, going through this work. Why? Because what I did in 1993 may not work anymore. That's why. And I've got to have the same thing happen to me. Central fact of my life today will be the absolute certainty. My Creator has entered into my hearts and He lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for me which I could never do by myself. And then, of course, I get into what I call middle-of-the-road solution, and I don't know about the rest of you, but AA is full of them. Absolutely full of them, you know. Stuff like take your time, page 28, encourages me to seek recovery with the desperation of a drowning man. I think there's a little conflict between those two statements.
Don't write inventory till you feel better.
Oh, yeah. Just, I mean, you could go on and on and on. 90 meetings in 90 days. Wow. Middle of the road solution. Once again, I see this thing about no return through human aid. And you know, I'm glad we did the prayer. I'm already feeling once again down in my gut. It's a feeling of, it starts with a little bit of anxiety, but before I leave here this Sunday, it's going to be stark raving terror because I'm going to see once again that no human power, my own, yours, or anyone else's, has kept me away from alcohol. And that's how it always starts, is my stomach starts to turn. And it started to turn when we said that prayer and began to look at stuff. And I'm kind of like Joe, I'm not going to run away from that anymore. I'll look at that terror. So we're going to go on a little bit further and